man in a strange taxi. Shuggy was in his clean pyjamas as they crossed Joni Micklewhite's threshold. Her house was the middle in a strip of semi-detached houses that circled the fattest of the grey high-rises. She had a concrete front yard and an asphalt backyard, and therefore they paid a higher rent rate to the council. As the boy crossed the front door, he noticed with awe that they had stairs in their house, two separate floors. That alone would kill Agnes. Joni Micklewhite was stood at the end of the short hallway with her fingers laced patiently in front of her round belly. She didn't say hello to the boy or to Shuck. She just nodded and turned back into the kitchen. It was late supper time when they arrived, and Shug led the boy into what he called the dining room. And Shuggy made a note to never tell his mother that they had stairs or a dining room. The boy sat in the middle of the folding table, and Joni scowled at one end, and his father glared at the other. Sat at the table already were six of Joni's wains. They looked ill-humoured and hungry, like they had been made to wait for something not that special. The youngest of Shug's stepchildren was a boy aged about 17. Only one was a girl, called Stephanie, and it was the only name Shuggy could remember from his father's introduction. He remembered partly because it was the most Protestant name he had ever heard, but also because, when Shug had first left, Catherine had threatened to kick the life out of Stephanie Mickleshite in an attempt to cheer up Agnes. Now sat across from her, Shuggy could see Catherine would have lost. Stephanie had thick, hairy forearms. Out of all of them, she hid her dislike for their new visitor the least. Shuggy sat quietly while the Micklewhite Baines recounted their days to his father. They had a lot to tell him. They had office jobs, they had cars, they were sticking in at school, or were waiting to hear from a university. One was training to be a teacher, and Stephanie worked in a place where everyone had something called a personal computer. They all called him Dad, which confused the boy, and they all wanted him to listen to them over the others, like he was an honoured guest. Shuggy was staring. He couldn't help it. Stephanie lowered her head almost onto the table, met his eyes with a cold glare, and asked if he would like to take a picture. After that, Shuggy tried to keep his eyes moving. He tried to surreptitiously soak in all the details of his father. He knew almost nothing about him, and while the others ate, he stole sideways glances at the man and wondered why he tolerated these other children but had left him. The strange man lifted his glass and drank his milk, and all the while his eyes scoured the others like a searchlight. He would lower the milk glass and with his other hand smooth the lines of his glossy moustache in satisfaction. Shuggy was nervously rubbing his own top lip when his father finally looked at him, and they regarded each other in silence. After dinner, Joni led the boy to where he would be sleeping. Despite the dining room, the Micklewhite house seemed very small. The eldest boy slept on a single bed in a narrow cupboard under the glorious stairs. He was a professor of chemistry or something, and his cupboard was decorated with Star Trek memorabilia, all suspended from the ceiling by invisible fishing gut. If their brightest and eldest was in the cupboard, the boy couldn't think where they were leading him. Joni took Shuggy upstairs and passed three or four small bedrooms. There was another Micklewhite, a seventh, a boy also called Hugh, who was away in the army cadets. Joni switched on the bare bulb and said that he, the new Hugh, could sleep here.
Temporarily, mind you.
The room was messy and felt stuck in a limbo between a child's and a man's bedroom. There were little green soldiers glued along the windowsill next to posters of a naked Samantha Fox. Hugh Micklewhite had kept his clothes clean and dirty alike in a heaped pile next to his bed. Shuggy cleared a space on the sheets and sat on the dented mattress. His head was swimming. He counted on his fingers. If you included Leek and Catherine, then Shug had 14 children. There were four of his own from his first marriage, then Shuggy, and he'd added Catherine and Leek, and then collected the 7 half-grown Micklewhites. His father had 3 sons named after himself, 1 Hugh per woman. After he had done the sums, Shuggy felt lucky to have had those 3 hours of his father's time. Big Shug took to hiding in his taxi. Double shifts, back shifts, night shifts, early shifts. For his part, Shuggy skulked around the shadows of the high-rises and hid from them all. In the mornings, Joni turned the boy out of the house. She told him that his father needed peace to sleep. That was what the night shift did to taxi men. At the front door, she pushed a jam piece and a peeled carrot into his hand and told him to go and play and not to come back till it was dark. She pointed out into the distance and waved her hand wide across the scheme, meaning he could go anywhere he pleased for all she cared. While every other Wayne was in school, Shuggy spent the time wandering the high-rises. Each floor of the high-rise had a shared laundry room between the flats. These were cavernous concrete rooms that had a wall of breeze blocks and so were open to the elements on one side. Housewives would hang their clean washing there and wait while the Glasgow wind battered it dry and froze it solid. Shuggy rode the lift, floor to floor, till eventually he would find a laundry room that was unlocked and open. The higher was always better, and he would sit with his legs and arms through the breeze blocks and look out over the sandstone city all the way to Sight Hill. The north wind would scald his face as he dropped little green soldiers to the ground below. He strained to see the black line on the horizon and tried to imagine her there. Was she missing him? Was she even alive? The boy had been dropping the green men to their deaths for nearly 3 weeks by the time Agnes came. Eventually, she had discharged herself. She telephoned and Shuggy watched with a dark curiosity as Joni Micklewhite spat hate as good as she got. He felt like a traitor, to be inside the Hoormaster's house, to have Joni hang up on his mother, and then to watch them laugh and degrade her and pick her apart like old chicken. The boy was heartbroken to watch them take joy in her misery. He died for the fear she might think he was now one of them, laughing down the phone at her. He thought about her wrists and the blood in the tea towels, and like a big baby, he cried from frustration right there in front of them. In a way, Joni changed her tune then. The boy didn't understand why she suddenly became sweet as sugar towards him. Shuggy had gone from being an imposition to being a useful pawn. To her, he was now a wonderful, magical, hurtful way to show Agnes Bain once and for all who was the winner. Agnes grew sick of all her threatening and all her tearful begging. She sat at her dressing table and set her hair into a hard crown of black roses with layer after layer of her expensive hairspray. She pulled on her tight black skirt and a fresh white blouse, and over this she wore her good purple mohair coat, making sure it was long enough to cover her tender bandaged wrists. She sank 3 cans in quick succession, and then she burst the gas meter open and called a taxi. Agnes had threatened to do it, and they hadn't believed her. Like bullies, they had felt safest in a crowd, and they had laughed down the phone in big ha-ha-has. Now, as she stepped out of the black Hackney, she asked the driver to kindly wait. "I won't be a minute," she said. "I'm only away to have the last laugh." With a proud clip, Agnes walked down the street counting up the odd numbers. Opening the metal gate, she stood in the small front yard and rubbed at her heart when she saw the double-glazed windows. She looked at the new windows and then at the two stories, and her mouth pulled wide in a sickened grimace. She checked the address on the torn piece of paper and then pulled down on the cuffs of her purple coat one last time. Agnes hammered on the door, but no one answered. There was a scurrying of feet by the peephole, and then there were voices giggling. Agnes hammered again, and then she stepped backwards.
"Shug!" she shouted. "Shug, Bain! Show your face, you wife-being whoremaster!"
She waited. There was no answer from inside the two-story house, but people on the street stopped dead in their tracks. They milled about behind postboxes and parked cars. Children laid their BMX bikes down in the dirt and scurried to get a better look. She could feel them all watching, and it emboldened her.
"Shug Bain, you bald-headed fuckface! Stop playing with your tiny cock and show your fucking self!"
Her voice bounced off the low buildings and carried clear across the high-rise flats. Agnes straightened her back and drew up her chest to scream again. And then something caught her eye. There was nothing in the paved front yard. Its concrete was perfectly flat and grey. There was nothing except for a few straggling weeds and, in the corner, two large silver rubbish bins. Agnes picked up the first bin. It was not yet full, not yet too heavy. In one clumsy motion, she twisted her body, her thin heels wobbling under her, and then slinging back around, let go of the bucket. Still weak from the hospital, she almost fell backwards, gracelessly through the gate. The metal bin flew through the air, and for a moment she thought it would bounce off the thick windows and do her a damage. She held her breath in fear it might miss. Agnes didn't miss. The bin found the centre of the window and crashed with an almighty clatter into the room. The glass broke into small ice-cubed pieces, and the proud net curtains were pulled down from their rod. The old women, who had stopped in the street, screamed for mercy. The children on BMX bikes whooped with excitement. The Micklewhites had been sitting, Walton style, at the dining room in the back of the house when Agnes had started hammering. Everyone but Shug jumped when they heard the noise from the front room. Joni, who had been laughing at Agnes over a serving dish of golden potatoes, was up and through first. When she saw the glass and the garbage, she screamed as if she had been knifed. By the time Shuggy had pushed through the tangle of Micklewhite legs, Joni was standing amidst the debris and rotten rubbish with her mouth open and hands flaccid by her side. Stephanie put her arm around her mother, lest she should keel over. The big colour television lay smashed on its face. Shuggy noticed it didn't have a coin meter. "Wait till I tell her that," he thought. There in the front yard, smiling, stunning, and mostly sober, was Agnes Bain. The boy wanted to scream, "Go!" He wanted to run a victory lap around this scheme with her. Shug made it to the front door first. With his arms pinned on either side of the doorframe, he stopped the rest of the Micklewhites from spilling out into the street. Their arms clawed at her around the bulk of him. It looked like the zombie horror films Leek let him watch. Agnes calmly put her hand into her bag and pulled out a long cigarette. Lighting it slowly, she took a long, elegant draw. "You bastard," she said, quite calmly. "Get my boy out here now." Joni, who was still amidst the glass, found her sharp tongue at last. She let out a shriek, the kind that starts at your toes and tightens all the muscles in the body till it erupts out of your mouth. "You all drunk whore. You're going to pay for that window, so help me God." Agnes picked at a fresh chip in her nail, She looked disappointed as she held her hand up to Joni.
Now look what you made me do.
She mugged and made her painted nails dance in a wave. She turned her cold eyes back to Shug and hissed through gritted dentures.
Get my boy out here now.
Joni pushed her way into the hall, past the boy and the other roaring bodies that Shug was using as girth to hold back. His face had flushed between scarlet and puce.
You all drunk! I'm going to fucking kill you!
Joni spat, her talons wildly scraping the air.
Shug Bane, I am warning you.
Agnes took another draw on the cigarette and looked down the street as more neighbours emerged from their homes. She moved closer to the second silver bin.
If you don't get my son out here now, I'll put in every window in this fucking street.
Joni kept clawing at the air around Shug and started spitting watery gobfuls into the street. Agnes only looked at her distastefully and went back to picking at the chip nail. Joni kept screaming like a banshee.
You're fucking mental! They should never let you out of the Maddy house!
In a fluid motion, Agnes dropped her cigarette on the ground and had her black high heels off and clutched in her hand. Agnes, who couldn't throw a ball straight, was feeling brave after the bin had found its mark. The first sharp stiletto sailed through the air and clattered against the doorframe and fell to the ground. Agnes shifted forward in her stocking feet and, like an experienced shot putter, let fly the second heel. It found its mark on the side of Joni's face. Joni staggered back into the hallway with a bloody yelp. The boys on bikes howled with wicked delight. They fell to the ground and furiously started gathering chucky stones, holding them out to this warrior woman and chanting for more blood.
Hear, hear, missus! Again! Again!
There was blood. A small amount only, but enough for Joni to wipe on her hand and rile up her brood. At the sight of the blood, the Micklewhite boys started to push harder to get out and lynch Agnes. Shug looked like his heart might burst from the strain. Shuggy could hardly see his mother standing in the front yard. The hallway was so full of bodies pushing against his father, and if he couldn't see through the mess of angry limbs, then he would never be able to reach her. He turned and retreated slowly up the hall and sleekly slid into the room on the left. He crossed the glass-strewn living room and stood on the large upended TV, using it as a step to climb up onto the window ledge. In one leap, he jumped up and over the jagged edge of the broken window and dropped down on the hard concrete outside. Shuggy moved cautiously towards his mother. She was gaunt and pinched-looking, and underneath her paint she was a grey, anemic colour he had never seen before. But she was alive. Shug watched his son tread delicately across the broken glass.
Shuggy, come here now,
he barked. The clack of Micklewhite voices behind him started to protest. They were braying for blood. They were telling Shug to let the boy go. He ignored them.
She's not going to get any better, son. Come away from there.
Shuggy paused for a second. He looked over his narrow shoulder bone and shrugged.
But she might.
Agnes was glaring up at Shug, her hand outstretched to her boy.
You can't see green shite, but you want it.
I know what's good for the boy.
His lip curdled under the bristles of his moustache.
You can't look after yourself. Never mind him. Fuck's sake. Look how twisted you've made him.
In her stocking feet, Agnes bent over and folded the boy in a deep embrace. The buttons of her good coat scratched at his face, but he didn't care. He choked her middle and tried to bury himself back into her flesh. His bottom lip started to tremble It protruded and rose like a heat blister. Agnes put her thumb gently on it and kissed the pale skin above his left ear. Her words were as warm and easy as the fair fortnight sun.
Shh! We've been greeting in front of them long enough. Not here. Don't give them the satisfaction.
She drew herself to her full height again, somewhat diminished without the black heels. She looked up at Shug and their grotesque chorus that longed to do her a damage.
Sometimes you don't even want a thing. You just can't bear anyone else to have it.
Without another word, Agnes took Shuggy's hand and led him out of the gate. The BMX boys were still screaming for blood. Agnes raised a hand to quiet them, but they took it as a salute. And then the whole street broke into a cheer.
Gun yourself, missus!
By the time they got into the back of the taxi, her boy was mute and staring up at her like she was an apparition. She cupped Shuggy's face with her painted fingers and turned his gaze out to the low house.
Get a good look. God help me, you'll never see that fat bastard again.
As they drove away, she held his chin. Shuggy watched his father struggle to push the Micklewhites back inside the hallway, as if he was stuffing an unpegged tent back into a bag. Now, there was a deflated roundness in his shoulders. All the gallus swagger of the past few weeks was gone. As they left the scheme, the BMX bikes circled the Hackney, soaring and diving like little starlings. Agnes pulled the boy into her sight, and he clung to her like a limpet. She held him tight for a long time and tried to ignore the scent of another woman's soap on his hair. He let her cry. He let her talk. And he didn't contradict her when she made him fine promises he knew she would be unable to keep. Chapter 26. Eugene parked the Hackney just beyond the house. He waited for the morning sun to come over the scheme and watched Leek come out the gate and lumber towards the bus stop. The young man dug his hands into his overall pockets, the weight of the tool bag digging into his right shoulder. From where Eugene watched him, he looked like a half-shut penknife, a thing that should be sharp and useful, that was instead closed and waiting and rusting. When Leek was gone, Eugene used the keys she had given him. When he went into the house, she was snoring in that thick way he had come to despise. He knew her head was backwards off the edge of the bed and that her larynx was struggling to cope under the clogged bile of last night's drink. He stood outside the door and knew he wouldn't stay today. Some mornings he had found that if he timed it correctly, he could find her after the drink of the previous day had left her and before she had soaked herself in fresh sadness. Then she would be small and a little pitiful. But she would be present, charming even. A thing he could look after, like a spindly plant he wanted to coax towards the sunlight. As he passed along the hallway, there were small sounds from the other bedroom. Neat footsteps. The sound of Shuggy's fingers searching through his tidy pencil case. Eugene went into the kitchen and placed his bags on the counter. He filled the fridge with fresh liver and butter, and at the back of the small pantry, he stacked 4 tins of tomato soup and 4 tins of sweet custard, like he had been doing every morning. It sat before him now, a wall of overflowing rations, the shelf groaning under the weight, and it made him feel better somehow. He made tea and toast for himself and for Shuggy. He left Shuggy's on the carpet outside his bedroom door and then sat at the kitchen table alone. There was yesterday's newspaper, but it had been a slow night and he had read it forwards and backwards already. He had even read the agony column, which he enjoyed reading and found truly insightful. but would never admit to anyone. Agnes's paper was split open to the classifieds. Jobs wanted, caravans for sale, and lonely hearts. She had been circling ads in her fat bingo marker, and as he drank the tea, he glanced at them. The pages of house exchanges were soaked with ink. She had circled anything that sounded far away from here, and Eugene was surprised not to feel saddened by it. Since Gartnavel Hospital, he had watched how she paced around like a caged animal. And when she wasn't picking at her arms, she'd pick at the window paint, the bed frame, the loose threads on the settee. He had come up behind her one morning and had needed to hold her tight, almost crush her between his arms until the picking anxiety left her. Now, from the bleeding ink, he could see she was picking a different scab. She had told him how she longed for a house in a more central, less insular scheme. He had been rubbing her back one morning as she told him she wanted to live somewhere she could have her anonymity back, a place her pride could be restored. Then she added timidly, somewhere Eugene could live with her like he was her man. He had said nothing then. He just continued to rub her back until she grew restless and picky and moved away. Eugene knew that if you asked the council to find you another house in another neighbourhood, they would place you on a long waiting list. Even the truly desperate had to wait for years for a council house, and if you already lived in one, you became very low priority. The wait to be rehoused was interminable, so if you already occupied a council house, the better approach was to try to execute a straight swap of houses, off the books, on the fly. The council didn't mind this. It cleared the backlog, and anything that kept the complaining masses from filing through the chamber doors was welcomed. In their view, exchanging one house for another only moved the problem around, or at least it kept it from their desk. Eugene stretched and tried to straighten his hunched spine. There was an old gas bill envelope next to the newspaper. She had been writing an advertisement and then scratching it out, again and again, till the wording was perfect. He could see Agnes had spent a long time thinking of the phrasing of her request, and that she had gotten slowly drunker as the evening wore on. When she was closer to sober, it read almost pitiful and pleading. And later, as she slid towards spitefulness, it sounded more demanding. She had eventually taken all the versions and cut them into one. In 30 words or less, she had made Pithead sound lovely, a pastoral and friendly place, neighbourly and thriving. In the ad, she stated she was willing to consider any offers. Eugene thought, had it been a Lonely Hearts ad, she would have been both desperate and a liar. He drained the dregs of his tea and stood up to leave. If he left now, she might never know he had been, and he could sleep peacefully in his own bed. He turned to go, but the boy was in the doorway. Shuggy was neatly dressed, his school bag lashed tight across his body. He saluted Eugene, as had become their way.
Night shift clocking off, sir.
Eugene put down his money belt again. He tried not to sound too deflated as he returned the limp salute.
Aye, day shift reporting for duty. I don't like you when you've got a drink in you,
was how he told her they were finally done. Eugene had come by, as he had taken to doing, at the end of his night shift, knowing it was the best chance to find her sober. Some nights, without undressing, he would lie with her in the warm bed, and they would talk about the funny punters he had seen or the shiny things she wanted for the house. If she was not too hungover, he would unzip his trousers and roll on top of her then. Agnes would try to push the sleep from her limbs and ignore the painful rubbing of his sheriff's belt on her belly. he would shove away at her, and before long they would both want it to stop. With a grunt, he would roll off her and kiss her on the cheek. He would say he was too jumpy to cuddle, and already dressed he would go sit in the dark kitchen and wait for her with the lights off. Agnes would get up and cook him something hot in the black frying pan and make him two mugs of strong black tea. She would set both mugs in front of him at the same time, side by side, and watch as he drank them in the one go, scalding hot, like they were glasses of water. They would talk a little longer, about nothing really, and he would slip her some money, just a few notes, enough for a loaf and perhaps some hairspray. Then he would kiss her, their first proper kiss of the visit, and he would go home to his own house and his own grown daughter and get into his own bed. Agnes waited until he had rolled on top of her one night, and as he shoved his way into her, she asked softly,
"Jeannie, when I get a house exchange, will you move in with us?"
Eugene stopped his thrusting, and she felt him slip out of her. His thick face was flushed round the edges. The look of boyish concentration dissolved as his features hardened themselves, preparing her for disappointment.
"No,"
he said simply, sliding out from between the warm sheets. Agnes felt so embarrassed that she couldn't sit up. For a long time, she just lay there in the dent they had made. She listened as he went to the kitchen, and she heard him pull out his chair and wait for the service. It took all the strength she had to raise herself. She poured herself onto the floor as though she were boneless. When she got into the kitchen, he spoke first.
"I don't like you when you've got a drink in you."
She knew what he meant. He had said it not as if they were lovers coming apart, but as if he had thought about it and was resigning from a job he hated. She wanted to tell him she didn't much like him when she didn't have a drink in her. But she didn't. She didn't have the strength to lie. There was no face left to save. Instead, she pushed two link sausages around in the pan until they burst. Then she made him two identical cups of dark tea with the tea bag left in. He drank them, and then he left. Shuggy never saw Eugene again. Agnes's boys could tell something was different. It was like how you can tell when a bonfire has petrol in it instead of just wood. In a fury, she drank herself into a sadness with lager, and when she was done with being sad, she changed to vodka and made herself angry again. For weeks, the door swung back and forth with Ginty and Bridie and Lambie and all the others who brought bags full of drink. For 2 weeks, Shuggy stayed away from the school and tried to keep her contained in the house. He locked the doors and ran all the outside messages. When she fell asleep sitting up in her chair, Shuggy took out his school books and tried not to fall so far behind.
"I'm getting out of here," spat Agnes one afternoon. "Phone me a taxi."
"But where?"
Shuggy asked, looking over the top of his textbook.
"Don't ask me where," she screamed. "Anywhere, anywhere away from here, away from you."
He tried not to flinch.
"But what will I tell the taxi man?"
"Tell him I want the lights, the action."
She smacked her lips.
"Tell him to take me to the bingo, for fuck's sake."
Shuggy picked up the phone and pretended to dial the number. He pressed 111-1111. He waited a moment and then blethered cheerfully into the empty receiver.
"Taxi? Yes, please, Bain. That's right. The big bingo. Okay, thanks."
He gently placed the receiver back in the cradle. Clearing his throat, he said,
The taxi man said it will be at least half an hour.
Agnes was already by the front door, her hand tugging on the handle. She danced from foot to foot like she needed the bathroom.
Fuck!
She squealed like a spoilt child.
Does nobody want me to have a life?
Mammy,
soothed Shuggy.
Your hair is sticking out on the one side. You can't go out like that. Come away in and we'll fix it.
No!
She spat, running her fingers through the tangles.
Come on. You can have another wee drink.
At that, Agnes let the leather bag slide from her shoulder onto the floor. She stumbled along the hallway. When he got her back into a chair, her head was already bobbing sleepily on her shoulders, as if she were on a very bumpy bus. On his knees at her side, he poured her a tall mugful. He used more vodka than Iron Brew. He handed it to her. She drank it like water. Her eyes sprang open.
Are you going to fix my hair then?
Sitting on the arm of the chair, he began to run the brush through her black hair. Agnes held the mug against her chin and slurped the sugary liquid into her mouth.
Has it been half an hour yet?
She asked.
No, Mammy, he sighed. I was going to go out and get you a new daddy.
He ran the thick brush around the side of her hair, and the hairspray cracked and dusted the air like sweet pollen. He liked the way the hair started to soften and feather.
That's okay. I don't need a daddy.
She shook her head mournfully, like she strongly disagreed.
Has it been half an hour yet? No, Mammy. Has it been half an hour yet? No, Mammy. I wish you would phone them again.
She fell asleep on the chair, her head dipped forward onto her chest, her breath throaty and irregular. As Agnes snored, Shuggy let his shoulders soften. He took the mug from her loose fingers. He knelt in front of her and gently unbuckled the strappy heels, sliding them off slowly, taking care that the buckle shouldn't rip her new tights. With steady hands, he unclipped the mismatched earrings. All these things he returned to her room in the hope that when she woke up, she would forget she had been trying to go out. Shuggy picked up the schoolbook again and, like a loyal dog, sat at Agnes's feet and listened to her heavy breathing. Through the front window, he watched the children start to trickle back from the day's school, shirt tails out, ties around their foreheads. They were sat together like that for only an hour, when Leek came in from work and slammed the front door shut. Shuggy looked nervously to his mother, then down the hallway to his brother, spook-faced with white plaster dust. Agnes made a sound like a generator starting, and Shuggy laid his head on his knees.
I want my dig money,
were the first words out of her mouth. Leek didn't answer his mother. He glared straight at Shuggy as if to say what a terrible job he had done keeping her from the drink. He mouthed a silent, nice one, and turned, with a slam, into his bedroom. Through the wall came the crashing guitars of Meatloaf, and Shuggy tilted his head back like a baying dog and shouted into the air.
I did my bloody best. Give us peace. Who are you to scream like that?
She jabbed her thumb sharply into her own chest.
I am the man of this house.
Me!
Agnes tottered along the hallway and rapped her rings on the thin bedroom door. The volume went up. Shuggy watched her sink back in her heel and stick her jaw out. He could see the short hour's sleep had only given her back her fire, but not taken any of the poison from her. Agnes rapped the big rings on the door one more time. There was a sound of a little snib sliding back in its bed. Leek stepped out into the hall. He had changed out of his work clothes and into his best denims, the ones he saved for the gambling machines in the city centre.
I raised you to answer me when I am talking to you.
Shuggy could see Leek was trying to be civil, to placate her. He bit the tip of his tongue before he answered her. Yes, Mommy. What is it?
What is it? What is it?
Agnes spun round the hall, looking at the ceiling in dramatic disbelief.
You expect me to cook and clean for you all week, and when I try and have a civil conversation with you, all I get is, yes, Mammy, what is it?
Too late, Leek opened his mouth to apologise, but Agnes battered on.
I'll tell you what it fucking is. I'm sat home all day rotting away with bawjaws there.
She thrust her thumb towards Shuggy.
And you come home and you can't even say two kind words to me.
I'm sorry.
Sorry? Not half as sorry as I am.
She drew her eyes up and down him, and they stuck in his blue jeans.
Are they new denims?
No.
I've not seen them before. They must have cost you a bob or two. Are you going down the pub in them?
Maybe.
What do you mean, maybe? You think I'm that daft?
Aye, I am then.
Well, I only wanted to know. Would you like some hot dinner before you go?
Leek blinked. Shuggy winced.
Yes, please.
Leek fell for it.
Aye, I bet you fucking would. Well, you don't pay me enough to keep hot food on this table.
Leek turned his back to her to lift his nylon bomber from the bed. The sight of his sharp shoulder made her furious, and Agnes jabbed her ring finger hard into the middle of his back. It caught him funny. Shuggy saw him twist from the pain.
Don't you turn your back on me when I am talking to you. Who do you think you are, pal?
She laced her fingers under her chin like a delicate fan.
All dressed up in your fancy boy denims. Off up the pub with all your wee woofter mates. You're nothing but a big old Jesse. A big old ponce, aren't you?
Something in the words made Leek look to Shuggy, who had turned the colour of grey ash. Those were the same words Shuggy heard every day on the streets of the mining town. The words he heard in the playground and at the back of the class. Something in that look told Shuggy that Leek knew he was not right. She was still roaring with the drink, but neither boy heard what she had been saying. The finger came out again and caught Leek in the middle of his bony chest. Something instinctual in him brought his hand up, and there was a loud crack as he swatted her knuckles away. Shuggy could see by the way she curled her sore fingers that it had hurt. Worse than that, it had hurt her pride. Agnes and Leek were both shaking in anger.
You think you are the man of my house? No way.
There were tears of fury on her face. She uncurled the finger into his chest again.
Get your stuff and get the fuck out of here. You're papped.
Mommy.
Leek sounded like a little boy again.
Papped!
There was a tremble in Leek's jaw. Shuggy saw it. It shook a moment, then it stiffened. A kind of locking started in his knees and travelled up his whole body, vertebra by vertebra, till he was standing solid as a stone pillar. Leek's shoulders straightened, and he held himself tall, taller than Shuggy had ever seen. Shuggy waited until his mother was hammering a number into the telephone before moving. He slunk along the hallway and slid into the bedroom. Around the walls were the cabinets and shelves Leek had made by hand from old pieces of YTS wood. Beautiful, functional things, rich with inlaid doors and sliding drawers for hidden stashes. Under the bedroom window was a massive plywood unit that housed Leek's turntables, his speakers and his records. Into the face of it, he had made dozens of little compartments to neatly hold exactly 10 albums apiece. The precise and careful hand was gone now, as he stuffed his life frantically into black bin bags.
Shut that fucking door,
he barked, as Shuggy came in. Shuggy did as he was told, closing their door gently, easing the ball lock into the socket. Leek was leafing through albums, deciding what to bring and what to discard. Shuggy crossed the room and put his index finger into a belt loop at Leek's waist. He twisted and twisted until all the blood was cut off from his fingertip.
She's only saying this to you all because Eugene's done it to her. Just wait. It'll pass.
Leek turned. He twisted his brother's hands free from his waist.
Jesus, Shuggy. I want to say something to you, and I want you to heed me, not just hear me, okay?
The boy nodded, slowly.
Look, you are the man of the house now, so you're going to have to grow up and do some things. You're going to have to look after her money for her. When she cashes the Monday and Tuesday books, you're going to have to keep a bit back to get your food through the end of the week. Do you think you could do that?
Shuggy wanted to say he already did that, that he had done that since he was 7.
You're going to have to keep her in and keep the rest of those alky bastards out. Unplug the phone when she is not looking. If they come to the door, try and turn them away. Tell them she's out. That goes double for men, all right?
Leek was still filling bin bags with the contents of his life. Unwanted things no longer of use to him, he threw into the corner. Even in his hurry, he made it look easy, as if he had thought about it 100 times before.
Men will only want to hurt her. Take advantage.
He paused.
Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes. He knew all about it,
more than Leek could ever imagine.
Are you going to stick in at the school?
I'll try.
Well, try harder. Don't make the same mistake as me, Shuggy. Make something of yourself.
Leek took a handful of Shuggy's hair in a tight fist and gently shook his head.
If you're worried about leaving her, then hide all the pills from the bathroom. While you're at it, hide the razors and steak knives as well. Wrap it all up in a tea towel, take it outside, and hide it in the bushes, all right?
Leek studied his brother for a moment.
What are you, like 13?
Leek exhaled upwards into his own fringe.
Shit. Your balls will be dropping soon. Look, it won't be for that long. Just a wee while longer till you can go too.
Shuggy's head pulled back on his neck in disgust.
Then who will look after her?
Well, she'll have to look after herself.
Then how will she ever get better?
Leek stopped his packing. He lowered himself onto one knee so that he was looking up at Shuggy. His lips were moving silently, almost like he didn't know quite where to start.
Don't make the same mistake as me. She's never going to get better. When the time is right, you have to leave. The only thing you can save is yourself.
Whatever weak power Leek had held over the house faded away as he left with the last of his black bin bags. The lowest of the demons came out of the off-licenses and bookies, and they filled her with a drink. They drank and they smoked together, and then they fell asleep, sat upright in her armchairs, only to wake and start drinking again. Shuggy tried to keep them away. He tried to hold on to a little money and get himself to school. He only wanted to do his best for Leek, to prove that she could get better. And maybe that would bring him home again. But it was hard.
Chapter 27. It was the first day in 3 weeks she hadn't woken up to a living room full of clammy, sodden bodies. It was a funny kind of lonely. Agnes sat and whimpered poor me's to herself for a while. She sat in the chair, which was surrounded by overflowing ashtrays, and put her head between her knees and tucked her hands up in her armpits to stop the shakes. She was unsure how long he had been sitting there, clutching the red mop bucket. But when she called his name, he looked as surprised to see her there as she had been to see him.
"Can I have a cuddle?"
she asked, pitifully. He crossed the room obediently and sat on the arm of her chair. He was taking a growing stretch again, and his arms easily encircled her shoulders. Each time he held her, he was less like a child. He was becoming something else, not yet a man, something like a stretch child, waiting to be inflated into adulthood. She clung to him while she could. He smelled fresh, like the fields outside. All he said was, "I don't want to live here anymore."
"No, me neither."
Agnes ran herself a hot, deep bath. To sweat felt good, and she felt some of the sourness leave her. She sloughed herself with a rough towel and got dressed in her best, taking care to match her jumper to her coat and shoes. With mutinous hands, she put on her face and combed her black hair carefully over the start of white roots. Finding the last of the Tuesday book money, she put it carefully into her pocket and left the house. The day was hot and close. 2 weeks of sunshine trying to soak up a year of rain. Still, she buttoned up her coat. They were watching as she came out the gate, standing in clusters with bean sauce down their jumpers and wains wrapped around their stretchy leggings. Agnes could hear what they were saying, and she knew that was the point. She pitied them for not even having the pride to run a brush through their hair. "Please, God, not long now," she thought, as she waved and held her head high. Grey men stood around the mouth of the miners' club, drinking their lager in the weak sun. Even though the weather was muggy and close, they all wore the thick black donkey jackets they had worn under the ground. As she passed, they turned into one another like shy penguins, talking in hushed tones. She heard her name whispered, heard her legends discussed. The bolder of the men watched her with hungry eyes over their pints of amber. She knew they only wanted to degrade her, bring her to a new low. She knew a handful of them who had taken her comforts in exchange for a bag of carry-out. When they were done, they all went home again to their scrawny wives and their mismatched bedding. It was all too small, too pitiful to care about anymore. After a long walk, she reached the string of shuttered shops on the side of the thoroughfare. As the cars screamed by, she realised now that this was the only time she got out of the pit town. The only time she was guaranteed to cross the marshes, to be around people who didn't believe they knew every sordid thing about her. She was walking in the sunshine, allowing herself this rare daydream of freedom when she saw her. Like a cat being cornered by a dog, the woman jumped and looked about herself nervously. For a minute, Agnes thought the woman might dart out, climb the low barrier, and try to run across the four lanes of screaming traffic. In a way, Agnes hoped that she would.
"Hello, Colleen."
The woman tried to circle around her on the narrow pavement. Agnes might have let her go, but not today. She stepped into a stride and said louder,
"I said, good morning, Colleen."
The withered woman was stuck, blocked from escaping by the screaming traffic.
"What are you saying that for?"
she asked.
"Why should I not say hello to you in the street?"
The woman lifted her eyes to Agnes's face for the first time and tried a vinegary smile. She pursed her lips in a grimace, which Agnes thought was a shame. The only thing that was plump and feminine on her face was her lips.
"I dunno."
"So, how is your brother keeping?"
The woman batted her light eyes.
Aye, grand, thanks.
Agnes hoped she was lying, but it hurt anyway.
Well, do you think now that we are finished you could stop phoning me?
Colleen placed her hand over her silver crucifix.
I don't know what you're on about.
I see. So you must take me for daft.
Agnes clacked her lips in the same way Lizzie had done when she was having none of it.
It surprised her.
Then she laughed.
Colleen, you breathe like an old cocker spaniel. In the future, when you phone someone to harass them, maybe you should try to shut your mouth and breathe through your nose.
The look of innocence slowly slid off Colleen's face like an ice lolly melting in the sun. The smug smile returned.
Well, you stay away from my brother and we'll see.
Agnes reached into her pocket and took out the old gas bill envelope. It listed the House Wanted for Exchange notice, the same one she had placed in the paper. She now planned to advertise in the newsagent's window. She handed it to Colleen, and as her eyes peered over it, Agnes noticed that the woman was a slow reader, her lips moving with each syllable. Agnes was glad she had taken the time to do it in her best cursive.
See? I'm trying to get away.
The woman snorted.
Too good for us, eh?
Agnes rocked back on her heels. She folded her arms.
You put me in mind of my second husband. You know that. You don't want me here. You don't want me away from here.
You're joking, right?
Colleen dropped her jaw in mock shock.
You come here to our wee scheme thinking you're some kind of big I am, walking around thinking yous are better than the rest of us, with your hairspray and your handbag there.
She thrust her finger at Agnes.
Ye and that funny wee boy trying to rub our noses in it, and the whole time yous are lying in your own piss and fucking other women's men. Lord, I've never seen such a hypocrite.
Here's hoping you never fall on hard times.
Oh, shove it. I nearly died when my Eugene came home and told me that he's taken up with the whore in the purple coat. My mammy was being tortured in heaven just watching the two of you carry on.
Agnes shook her head. Those would be some bloody binoculars.
I suppose it's all a big joke to the likes of you.
Well, it's all finished. You win.
Your mother can rest her neck curtains now.
Colleen's face had worked up to such a shade of red that the woman looked as if she might burst.
It's much too late for that lady. Do you think his poor wife is going to want him now when he joins her? There's nothing he can do to make it up after being with you.
Agnes sank back on her heel. She twisted the back of her earring.
Well, I can say I've heard it all now.
There was a look of pure hate in Colleen's eyes.
You've heard nothing. He only came to you in the night because he was that embarrassed by you, creeping around like a thief. That's why only taxi drivers will have you, isn't it? So they don't have to be caught by your side in the daylight.
Is that so?
The thin woman smiled triumphant. She looked unburdened. Happy to have said our piece.
Aye.
We'll never get on, will we?
Never. How does that grab yous?
Fine,
said Agnes. She turned and headed towards the bombed-out shops.
Oh, and Colleen.
She motioned to the woman's neck. Then she ran a painted finger across her own pale collarbone.
You've got a ring of dirt there around your neck. You maybe want to take a cloth to that before you step over the door in the morning. It fair spoils the lovely glint of your crucifix.
The woman sneered.
That the best you've got?
Agnes closed her coat against her neck and smiled goodbye.
Oh, and I fucked your man. It was lousy.
She sniffed distastefully at the memory of it.
He had a line of skid marks in his underwear that was a pure embarrassment.
The door went all afternoon. At first, the McAvenny girls tried to lure him outside, told him they had sweeties that they wanted to share. But he knew the McAvenny girls, and he knew their brothers would be hiding amongst the council bushes. They kept coming to the door, and when he stopped answering, they took to spitting through the letterbox, big long gobbets of sugary phlegm that stuck in the metal flap and slid slowly down the inside of the wood. Shuggy hid in the corner, watched them gob their mess, and tried to wipe it with a rag before it slid onto a good carpet. Whatever Agnes had done now, Shuggy couldn't say, but they had filthy words for her. New names that sounded dank and fusty. Women's words that put spittle on their lips and made sucking sounds like a boot in the coal slag. The imaginary moat Eugene had laid around the Bain house was gone now. He rolled it up as easily as a carpet when he left. Now the McAvenny Wains hammered their feet against the locked door. They shouted all the familiar poncy names at him. They made slurping kissing noises. Then they made sing-songs of kissing noises. And then started the dirty names again. When the girls grew tired of tormenting him, Francis McAvenny finally came to the door. Shuggy was ready to open it. He was so tired that he wanted to end it, take whatever was due to him, and close the door again. Francis was nearly 2 years older than Shuggy. He was at the big school now, separated from his brother Gerbil, and there was thick hair in his top lip. He'd started fingering a Protestant lassie. His little sisters told the scheme all about it, with an odd mixture of disgust and pride. When Francis's eyes appeared at the letterbox, Shuggy thought he would spit through it like his siblings had. He folded the soaking rag and readied himself to catch the dribble. Instead, Francis's big pink lips just started to talk softly through the slot.
Shuggy. Shuggy. I know you're in there. Open the door. Go on. I want to talk to you.
He had never spoken so sweetly to Shuggy before. The words poured out slowly, like the trickle from a hot tap.
Will you now open the door, Shuggy?
No.
Their eyes met through the slot, and Shuggy noticed that the sallow-skinned boy had thick eyelashes, like the bristles on a scrubbing brush. Francis said,
"I heard yous were flitting. I came to tell you I was sorry for being a wee prick."
Shuggy heard him ferret around in his pocket. He came back to the slot and pushed the body of a gold robot through the letterbox. C-3PO's severed head was bound on with clumsy Christmas sellotape. An old, childish toy, long ruined. A measly peace offering.
"If you put a wee dab of glue on it, it'll be good as new."
The older boy moved his eyes away and lifted his mouth to the slot to show he was smiling. His teeth were as big and smooth as white beach pebbles.
"Just open the door."
"No."
"Why do yous hate us?"
asked Francis quietly.
"I don't. You hate me."
"No."
He sounded offended.
"It's only banter, like."
Shuggy could tell Francis was thinking hard about what to say next.
"I want to make it up to yous, for always noising you up."
His brows knotted.
"Do you want to kiss us?"
"What?"
Francis put his lips to the slot again. There was a faint blemish of an old scar on the top bow. His father, Big Jamesy, had been fast with the back of his hand.
"I mean, I will let you, if you don't tell anybody's. I'll let you kiss us. That's what you were always after, eh?"
He sniffed.
"Just open the door."
Shuggy waited. He didn't trust the feeling that was writhing in his belly now.
"Why would I want to kiss you?
Come on, you know what you're like."
Shuggy peeled away the clear sellotape. The head fell off the gold robot and rolled across the carpet.
Francis? Are we friends now? Really?
Aye, surely.
Okay. Then put your mouth up to the letterbox.
No, just open the door.
The voice sounded almost pleading.
Just do it, all right?
Shuggy could hear the McAvenny boy hesitate. He was certain that at any moment Francis would balk, that he would call his bluff. It was silent for a painful moment. Then he heard the scrape of shirt buttons on the door as Francis pressed himself against the outside.
One kiss, then you'll open the door.
The voice was so clear, it sounded like it was inside the room. Shuggy closed his eyes and got on his knees. He put his face to the letterbox. Francis's breath smelled sweet and sugary, like supermarket jam. Shuggy could feel his sticky breath flood over his lips, and for a moment he wanted only to put his fingers through the hole to touch Francis gently. But the moment passed. Shuggy brought his hand to the opening and, as quickly as he could, he pushed the wet rag through, the one soaked in the spit of his tormentors. It was folded so the greenest, phlegmiest part was to the outside. He felt it touch the other boy's face, felt the resistance. Then he felt Francis pull away from the door as the tea towel slid out. Shuggy leaned against the door. He could hear Francis hacking the sour spit out of his mouth. Francis brought his teeth back to the letterbox. They were snarling now, nipping and biting to tear at Shuggy.
Ah, you better not open the door. I'm going to fucking stab you, you poncy little prick.
There was a thump thump against the door, like a hard fist against the wood. Shuggy recoiled as Colleen's kitchen knife shot through the slot and jabbed wildly in the air. Shuggy pressed himself against the inner draft door and watched as the silver blade darted in and out of the letterbox. It searched blindly for his flesh, its edge so keen and sharp it screeched as it sawed back and forth against the metal flap. Davy Perlando, the rag and bone man, came to the door three times with his wagon. He took anything Agnes offered and paid her with a roll of grubby pound notes bound by an old elastoplast. He couldn't believe his luck at the beautiful woman's generosity or blind stupidity. When he talked, he was jumpy and nervous, like he was constantly improvising, because he couldn't tell which it was. Was she daft or was she good? It was hard to tell because her eyes were glazed with a kind of apathy. When Davy offloaded the remnants of Lizzie's wedding china, he made a last trip to the wagon. He usually gave Waynes a whistle or plastic toy, but he handed Shuggy a whole box full of grubby balloons, enough to last him the entire rag season, all misprinted seconds emblazoned with the smeared offset of proud corporate sponsors. Davy did a trick where he blew up a balloon through clamped lips by slipping the rubber neck between the teeth he was missing in the front. He handed the damp balloon to the neat boy and read it slowly, as if Shuggy could not read for himself.
See, it says, Glasgow's miles better.
Than what? Asked Shuggy pointedly.
The ease with which Agnes was now willing to part with things was unnerving Shuggy. Whatever furniture the rag and bone man did not cart away at a steal, Agnes returned to the rental centre. She sent back all the furniture that was on hire purchase that she could. Then she took out a hobbling Provident loan to buy new and better when they made it to the city. He could sense the fever that had fallen on her, the dream of being a new person surrounded by new things. It made her clammy as any flu. She gathered up all the years of Kensita's cigarette coupons and counted them obsessively. All bound together, they made dense little bricks, little ingots that still smelled of sweet golden tobacco. Shuggy lay on the carpet and built walls and forts from them as Agnes went through the Kensita's catalogue, tabbing the corner to mark lamps and tea trays she only half liked, and kept a worried-looking total on a gas bill envelope. Shuggy watched her and said under his breath,
"Why can't I be enough?"
But she wasn't listening. Agnes had packed up the house quickly, starting as soon as the exchange was agreed upon. She looked at most of their belongings as though they had hurt her in some way. The packing was mostly done in an afternoon, both of them keen to be gone and preferring to live the last weeks in a packed-up house full of unsullied dreams and anticipation. Shuggy helped her wrap the precious ornaments, taking care to fold them all into old newspaper and then tuck them in a box amongst her underwear. When her back was turned, he took things of Leek's from the pile of discarded items, some old records, half-filled sketchbooks, and an old stuffed leprechaun of Catherine's, and then hid them safely amongst his mother's moving boxes. The last of his siblings' belongings she gave to David Parlando for a roll of dirty notes. The night before they moved, she burst the television meter one last time and bought handfuls of chocolate at the ice cream van. She laid all her old clothes out for Shuggy, and they sat with their knees touching, deciding what versions of her to bring and what to leave behind.
"People don't really wear stuff like that anymore," Shuggy said.
She had slipped on a fuzzy black jumper, the yarn like a trillion droopy eyelashes. She nibbled a corner of mint chocolate.
"But what if I belt it?"
She pressed her hand against her cinched waist. Shuggy reached inside her jumper, unbuttoned the two white shoulder pads, and removed them. Suddenly, she seemed less severe. She was softer and younger looking. He squinted.
"If you'd wear denims, then maybe that's better."
He put the pads inside his own school jumper and his shoulders raised to his jawbone. Her face puckered.
"Ugh, I'm too old for denims. They make everything look common now."
Shuggy leaned forward and took up a wool A-line skirt the colour of dead heather. It was tight, but not too tight. He had never seen her wear it.
"I like this one."
Agnes considered it. She flicked the zipper as if checking to see whether it still worked and then tossed it aside.
"No, I don't want to be her. She wears men's house slippers and keeps her penny on all day." "You would be comfortable."
His mother lay back on the carpet with a huff. She turned and ran her eyes the length of him.
"So, who do you want to be when we move?"
He shrugged.
"I don't know. I've been too busy worrying about you. God, it's Mother Teresa herself."
Agnes looked crabbed then. She propped herself up on one elbow and took a drink from her lager mug. She scowled into the cirrus patterns that were forming on the top of her ale.
"Look, when we get to the tenement, I'll give up the drink. I promise." "I know."
He tried a smile.
"I'll get a wee job like other mammies."
"I would like that." Agnes picked at a hangnail.
"Your bastard of a father never liked me to work. A woman's place and all that guff."
It was true. Shug had never suffered her to work, nor had Brendan McGowan. For the Catholic, it had been a matter of pride. He worked his hardest so the neighbours knew he could provide for his entire family. For Shug, it had been that he was not to be trusted, and therefore he was unable to place his trust in anyone else, least of all his own wife. He preferred her at home, to know where she was all day. Her men never liked her to work, so she never really developed the taste for it.
"You're too good to work. You're too lovely."
He knew what to say. They had talked like this 100 times before. It came out too flat, but still Agnes seemed assuaged.
Then he said something unexpected that froze